the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. What about children's literature? Should it be subversive? That's an issue that's addressed in a major essay published in the New York Review of Books, and I blogged about it today at albertmohler.com. We're going to be talking about it with specific reference to the works of C.S. Lewis, especially The Chronicles of Narnia, and with reference to the movie, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is even now still setting box office records in terms of this kind of movie. I think it's the kind of discussion that parents are going to find very, very interesting, because it tells us a lot about what those who are really shaping this culture think about when it comes to how a children's story should be told. Just to give you a hint, the reviewer we're going to be looking at today suggests that The Chronicles of Narnia are dangerous because they teach children to respect authority. And they point to the necessity of a God who would help children, or for that matter, anyone else, in distress. Our phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news. Big news out of Canada today, as, of course, the Canadian election is ongoing even now. And it looks like the Conservatives are going to win. The last polling data indicated that the Conservative Party is leading the Labour Party by about 10 percentage points. And that's shaping up for a major win for the Conservative Party there under the leadership of Stephen Harper. Of course, the Labour Party has been the longest ruling party in terms of a Western democracy in Canada there for many years, and is now under the leadership of Paul Martin. And under Prime Minister Paul Martin's leadership, the Liberal Party has become really the party of scandal. And for that reason, it looks like the Canadian people have finally had enough. Of course, we will not know until the final results are in. But it certainly looks like the Canadian Conservative Party is headed for a victory. Now, there's some very interesting aspects to this, as a matter of fact, with all this coming together with the election. For instance, Stephen Harper leads a party known as the Conservative Party, but it's not as conservative as, for instance, the Republican Party here in the United States of America. And as a matter of fact, Stephen Harper has had to run with some distance from President George W. Bush. One of the realities of Canadian politics is that everything has to have some reference to the United States. The United States is just such a big presence culturally, economically, and politically on the Canadian scene. And there has been a lot of antipathy towards this president, American president, and his foreign policy. And so Stephen Harper has held his distance, but that's not enough for many. And you're going to love this. Guess who one of the commentators on this election is? Well, you won't be surprised. It's Michael Moore. And Michael Moore had this to say to the Canadians, and I'm sure the Canadians were glad to get this advice. He has posted on his website and also broadcast through other media a warning to the Canadian people that they should not elect Stephen Harper in the Conservative Party. And this is what he says. He says, "Oh, Canada, you're not really going to elect a Conservative majority on Monday, are you? That's a joke, right? I know you have a great sense of humor, but this is no longer funny." He goes on to say, "First, you had the courage to stand against the war in Iraq, and then you elect a prime minister who's for it. You declare gay people to have equal rights, and then you elect a man who says they don't. A man running the nation to the south of you is hoping you can lend him a hand by picking Stephen Harper because he's a man who shares his worldview. Do you want to help George Bush by turning Canada into his latest conquest?" Don't you love this kind of language? You know, I'm sure the Canadians are quite willing to receive any word of wisdom from any source, including Americans, including even Michael Moore. But I can't believe they're going to take this seriously. You're going to love this last part. "Far be it from me as an American to suggest what you should do." By the way, anytime someone begins a sentence saying, "Far be it from me to tell you what you should do," they're about to tell you what you should do. And this is what he says. "I hope you don't feel this appeal of mine is too intrusive, but I just couldn't sit by as your friend," turning the page here, "and say nothing." So he says, "I just couldn't sit by as your friend and say nothing." Well, I don't think any of us guessed that Michael Moore could sit by and say nothing. We'll be looking tomorrow at the results from the Canadian election. The indications with a 10-point lead are that the Conservatives are going to gain a majority, but a rather slim majority in the Canadian Parliament, which will mean that some kind of coalition government is likely. But I do see this as good news, if for nothing else, because a change of the scene in terms of the relationship between the Canadian government and the American government is welcome. That could be very good news indeed. Brokeback Mountain is winning more awards, this one from the Producers Guild of America. The Ang Lee-directed film has now picked up its award. The PGA Award is considered one of those leading up to the Oscars coming in just a couple of weeks, a few weeks. The Producers Guild of America represents 2,700 TV and film producers, and its black tie event was held at the Universal Hilton Hotel. It was hosted by Queen Latifah, and evidently it was quite a do, but they gave the award to Brokeback Mountain for Best Picture, and once again, you have top honors going to the movie celebrating two homosexual cowboys. I continue to be fascinated by this because what we're getting from the left is a double message, a contradictory message. We're getting the message that this really isn't about sex, and those who think it's about sex have a hang-up about sex. But then we're getting the other message, which is, of course it's about sex. It's about the fact that this is a beautiful romance and ought to be celebrated as a beautiful romance, and if you don't get that, then you're homophobic. So they can't decide whether it is or isn't about sex, but the major theme of the discussion about the movie is about sex. And in this case, specifically, about the homosexual relationship between these two cowboys. Yesterday was the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the 33rd anniversary since the passage, actually the handing down of that decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And as usual, with this anniversary, there were different events on both sides of the abortion controversy. A March for Life in Washington, D.C., President George W. Bush made comments by telephone. This is what he said to the group assembled there on the Mall. He said, "You believe, as I do, that every human life has value, that the strong have a duty to protect the weak, and that the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence apply to everyone, not just to those considered healthy or wanted or convenient. These principles call us to defend the sick and the dying, persons with disabilities and birth defects, all who are weak and vulnerable, especially unborn children." He went on to say, "By changing laws, we can change our culture, and your persistence and prayers, and he says, are making a real difference. We, of course, seek common ground where possible. We're working to persuade more of our fellow Americans of the rightness of our cause, and this is a cause that appeals to the conscience of our citizens and is rooted in America's deepest principles, and history tells us that with such a cause, we will prevail." Now, this raises an interesting point about our democratic experiment, and that's what it is. We're over 200 years old as a nation. Our government continues to operate as a representative democracy, but in every generation, there are threats, challenges, stresses, and strains to the whole idea of a representative democracy, and one of them coming right now has to do with the issue of abortion, because there is increasingly the realization in this country that a majority of Americans do not support the kind of unlimited access to abortion that was guaranteed by Roe v. Wade. And so what you have on the left right now is a continuing cry that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, then millions and millions of American women would not have access to abortion. And why is that? It's because there would be, in many, many states in this country, no majority that would be pro-abortion. And so when you're talking about issues of federalism and constitutionalism, and you're talking about representative democracy, you have to decide whether you believe in it or not. And let me just suggest to you that this is where those on the cultural left and those on the cultural right are both going to have to find out, looking at themselves in the mirror, if they really believe in representative democracy. And this is just a word of prediction. On the left, the big issue is going to have to be the abortion issue. And on the right, the big issue is going to be the homosexuality issue. Because we're going to find out where Americans really stand on those two issues. And here's my prediction. Over a matter of time, our nation's laws and policies will be aligned with the majority of where Americans are, where the majority of Americans stand on these issues. And we're going to find out just where a representative democracy will take us here in the 21st century. And here as we're looking at the third century of the American experiment. Now, for Christians, let me just suggest this points out that democracy is not always the answer. Now, how's that for a deeply subversive message? In other words, a democracy may be the fairest form of government that we are able to achieve. And by that, I mean a representative democracy, not a mobocracy. But at the end of the day, we have to realize that a government is no better than its citizens. And democracy may be the fairest means, the most representative means of arranging a government, but that doesn't mean that democracy is the right way to arrange morality. And that's where the Christian gospel comes with a very deeply subversive message, that there is something greater than public opinion that is the authority in establishing morality. What is right? What is good? You know, these days, while we're talking about exporting democracy to the rest of the world, we need to remember that sometimes that old adage comes literally true. We get the government we deserve. And ultimately, that's true for any people, especially for those who have the right and privilege of a vote. Well, we will watch with you what's going on in Canada. We'll observe that election and be ready to comment on it tomorrow. But let's remember that every day in this country, individual citizens are making decisions, moral decisions, spiritual decisions, real life decisions, guided by the laws, yes, taught by the culture, yes. But we as Christians understand that we, everyone, will stand accountable to God for the decisions that we make. We'll be right back to talk about children's literature, subversive or not. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I just finished leading a three-week session on Sunday nights on teenagers, that means adolescents and mass culture. And on Sunday nights, I really appreciate the fact the church was concerned about this. So at Highview Baptist Church here in Louisville, Kentucky, I held these three open sessions on Sunday nights, and we had several hundred parents there just talking about what it means for our young people to be so deeply embedded in mass culture. And I say our young people, we all are, adults too. But with a special focus upon young adults and upon children, that's what I was really addressing. And of course, one of the things I had to mention in the course of these 3 weeks was that which is now labeled as young adult literature or children's literature, children's stories, because this has become a real battleground. And if you don't know that, well, just hear me today. You need to know that. You need to understand that there are many people out there who realize that the way to reach a lot of these young people and children is through the narratives they will read, the fantasy stories, the books, and all the rest. And there's a lot out there like this. For instance, the young adult literature section has become really a means of indoctrinating a lot of kids into the kind of sexual permissiveness and celebration of sexuality and heterosexuality, homosexuality, and all the rest that is now rampant in adult culture, and yet it comes packaged by major publishers. It comes looking like an attractive book, and yet you start looking at it, and there are some deeply, deeply troubling messages being broadcast and published for our young people there. Now, I assume that kids are going to read a lot of things that will require them to exercise discernment. I mean, that's true if you're reading Jonathan Swift or William Shakespeare, for that matter. But when it comes to this literature I'm talking about, it comes with an explicit, very explicit moral agenda. And that moral agenda is towards the normalization of things like homosexuality and same-sex marriage and a celebration of sexual experimentation. And then at the other level of children's literature, it's not so much that you have this overt sexuality. What you find in literature for school-age children and preschoolers is the message of tolerance. You see that in a lot of the stuff. You start seeing the picture books with pictures of men and men holding hands and women holding hands and all the rest. And you don't have to have a PhD in literature to know what's going on there. But today, as I was reading the New York Review of Books, which is perhaps the nation's leading intellectual newspaper, and it deserves that title because it publishes some of the most incisive and thoughtful reviews of books and also essays concerning contemporary events. So the New York Review of Books has published a review of C.S. Lewis, especially of the film The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and of two books about Lewis. And this particular review essay is written by Allison Lurie of Cornell University. And Lurie, by the way, is the author of two books. One of them, Don't Tell the Grown-Ups, The Subversive Power of Children's Literature. And the second book, Boys and Girls Forever, Children's Classics from Cinderella to Harry Potter. Now, here's the deal. I fully expect that if you have a secularist agenda, you're not going to appreciate C.S. Lewis. I fully expect that if you do not like Christianity, and it's hard to put it any more simply than that, if you see Christianity as the problem rather than the solution, you're going to see C.S. Lewis as a problem. And that's especially and particularly what Allison Lurie has taken as her concern in her review of C.S. Lewis and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in particular the whole Chronicles of Narnia series. She begins by suggesting, and I quote, "The Narnia books have always been popular with conservative Christians, perhaps not only for their partly concealed religious message, but also for their underlying social and political implications." Now, Ms. Lurie's assumption is that children's literature should be unpolluted by Christian themes. She says this, and I quote, "Many critics who first read the Chronicles of Narnia as children report being unaware of its Christian meanings or of any other hidden messages, but several complain that when they reread the books as adults, they were shocked and dismayed." Interestingly, Lurie largely hides behind the criticism of others, especially the assault undertaken by Philip Pullman. You'll remember Pullman as the author of the trilogy, His Dark Materials. And if the Chronicles of Narnia is really an allegory that is to portray a Christian worldview, then His Dark Materials is literally the opposite of that. Phil Pullman has attempted to answer C.S. Lewis from an atheistic viewpoint, seeing the church and the Christian gospel as the enemy and the message to be avoided rather than embraced. In the end, she offers her own critique, and I want you to hear this, two particular paragraphs, because this tells us so much. And I just have to believe this is going to spark your discussion. Listen to what she says about C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia. Now, everything I read from this point on is going to be taken directly from her essay just published in the New York Review of Books. So listen to her here. "It is no surprise that conservative Christians admire these books. They teach us to accept authority, to love and follow our leaders instinctively, as children in the Narnia books love and follow Aslan. By implication, they suggest that we should and will admire and fear and obey whatever impressive-looking and powerful male authority figures we come in contact with. They also suggest that without the help of Aslan, that is, of such powerful figures or their representatives on Earth, we are bound to fail. Alone, we are weak and ignorant and helpless. Individual initiative is limited. Almost everything has already been planned out for us in advance, and we cannot know anything or achieve anything without the help of God. This is, of course, the kind of mindset that evangelical churches prefer and cultivate, the kind that makes people vote against their own economic and social interests, that makes successful, attractive, and apparently intelligent young men and women want to become the apprentices of Donald Trump or of much worse, rich and powerful figures. This mindset could even be called deluded, since in this world, a giant lion does not usually appear to see that the right side wins and that all the good people are happy. In Narnia, faith in Aslan, who comes among his followers and speaks to them, may make sense. But here on Earth, as the classic folk tales have told us for generations, it is better to depend on your own courage and wit and skill and the good advice of less than omnipotent beings." Now, I find that statement not so much shocking as tragic. I am a bit surprised that it appears in this timing in the New York Review of Books. But I'm not surprised that what we have here is a professor at Cornell University who identifies herself as a feminist and a secularist by this essay and others that she has written, who sees C.S. Lewis as the problem and thinks that the particularly dangerous aspect or problematic aspect of Lewis's work, The Chronicles of Narnia, is that it teaches children to trust authority figures such as Aslan, the lion representing Christ, and teaches them, as I end the article by citing her here again, that without the intervention of God in Christ, we would fail and evil would conquer. Well, you know, that really is the Christian story, isn't it? I mean, if she got anything right, it was understanding the very essence of the gospel here, that we are helpless without Aslan. We are helpless without Christ. Now, the kind of children's literature that Alison Lurie prefers is a literature that tells them that they are on their own. And as she makes very clear in this article, the kind of literature that tells them that adults are not so much to be trusted. As a matter of fact, she prefers His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, along with other works such as the Harry Potter series and Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, because she suggests that in those children's stories, children come to understand that not all adults are to be trusted, that adults do not necessarily have their best interest at heart, and that they must use their wits, they must use their intelligence, their own fortitude and resources to establish their own future without help from anyone else. Now, is that the message you want your kids to have? When she talks about children's literature being subversive, she means subversive of adult authority, of parental authority, and of the idea that we must obey some kind of divine authority. Well, C.S. Lewis once thought that way. But as he wrote in his own spiritual autobiography, he was surprised by joy in coming to know God in Christ. The Chronicles of Narnia is his account for children of the story, the great story, of how we can come to know God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Is that the problem or the solution? The number 877-893-8255. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The issue of children's literature, you know, you don't expect that to be the stuff of controversy, but if you go to the public school library, if you go to the public library, the American Booksellers Association, or your local bookstore, you're going to find that this is a hotly contested area in our culture, because the messages that are communicated to children help to shape their worldview, shape their hearts and minds as they come to understand reality. And there have always been stories out there that have warned children that there are bad people. I mean, everything from Hansel and Gretel and the Brothers Grimm to contemporary Disney movies and all the rest. I mean, there are wicked stepmothers out there in Cinderella. There are people who will do awful things. And by the way, they're beautiful and sweet stepmothers too. But there are just all kinds of messages out there just warning children you have to watch out. And I just saw the Lemony Snicket movie, and, you know, that one's just filled with all kinds of adult characters that are really evil and wretched, along with some that are merely eccentric and weird. But there's no one who is a trustworthy adult. Those children really do appear to be alone, and there seems to be almost no one who really cares about their best interest, at least no one who lives very long. But when it comes to the Chronicles of Narnia, I am somewhat surprised by the vehemence with which Alison Lurie has gone after the series, based upon the fact that she zeroes in on the very reality that the Pevensey children have been encouraged over the course of the story to trust Aslan. The Pevensey children are these little children, and some of them are of course adolescents. You take the four kids; they come one by one to understand who Aslan is, and then to trust him. And in the boys, it brings out courage, and in the girls as well. It brings out trust. And just watching Lucy Pevensey and seeing how she comes to trust Aslan is just a story. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's a picture in miniature of how a sinner comes in trust to the Lord Jesus Christ. It's not precisely an allegory, but there are allusions to the gospel, and we know it, and the other side knows it. And so whether you're a Christian or you just despise the Christian gospel, either way, you understand exactly what's going on here. But Alison Lurie goes on to argue that this is really dangerous. She doesn't use that word, but she certainly sees it regrettable that children would be getting this message, a message that they should trust adults. Now, I am offended by the way she twists this in terms of her understanding of evangelical Christianity. And by the way, she's rather loose with that kind of criticism. But when I read you there, in which she says, you know, this kind of trust is exactly what evangelical Christians want. It says here they prefer and cultivate. And let me just remind you, she said this, the kind that makes people vote against their own economic and social interests. Well, there's the Thomas Frank theory all over again. There's Michael Moore. We're hearing from him all over again. And the voice of this left-wing academic who says, look, you know, if these evangelicals really knew what was in their best interest, they'd be voting to confiscate money from the rich and et cetera. So that's exactly what she's talking about here is class warfare. Thomas Frank's theory, what's wrong with or what's the matter with Kansas? But then she goes on and says that makes them or that makes successful, attractive and apparently intelligent young men and women want to become the apprentices of Donald Trump or of much worse, rich and powerful figures. Now, here again, is that your church? Is that true of the evangelical parents you know? Not the ones I know. But she really gets down to it when she says this mindset could even be called deluded, since in this world, a giant lion does not usually appear to see that the right side wins and all the good people are happy. I think it's interesting there she puts usually. She has to condition that statement just a little bit. But then she says, in Narnia, faith in Aslan, who comes among his followers and speaks to them, may make sense. This is the heart of her argument. She says, in Narnia, this kind of story may make sense, but not here on earth. Instead, here on earth, we learn the wisdom of the classic folk tales, that it is better to depend upon your own courage and wit and skill and the good advice of less than omnipotent beings. Now, here's my thesis, folks. All children's literature is subversive. All of it. Now, Alison Lurie wrote a book entitled Don't Tell the Grown-Ups, The Subversive Power of Children's Literature. I want to tell you, it's all subversive. It's a matter of what is subverted. The kind of literature that Alison Lurie likes subverts parental authority and subverts authority in general and suggests that we don't need a God, what we need is to look within. That subverts the Christian gospel, subverts parental authority. But you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Chronicles of Narnia, is also a deeply subversive story. But what it subverts is the wisdom of the world. What it subverts is the kind of wisdom that so many would like to present to our children, that the way to liberation is to disobey, that the way to deal with authority is to disrespect it, that you can't trust adults, and that you don't need a savior. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. What would you rather your kids read, and what kind of subversive do you want them to be? Coast to Coast, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. What kind of literature do you want your kids to read? What kind of world do you want it to subvert? You see, I believe all literature is subversive one way or another. It doesn't matter what is subverted. We have two different worldviews in this culture, and whether you want to reduce it to some kind of conflict like the culture war, let's just say there is, at any event, a multiplicity of worldviews out there. But there are two dominant themes, and one of them is the theme that is offered by the Christian gospel, having to do with exactly the kind of story you find in the Chronicles of Narnia. And the other one is the anti-myth, the anti-story, the opposing narrative out there, which also shapes this culture, that has to do with exactly what Philip Pullman's doing in his Dark Materials, and to a lesser extent in the Harry Potter and Lemony Snicket series as well. Now, the question is, do you want to subvert the dominant culture in terms of its anti-authoritarianism, its love of autonomy, its hymns to the self? Or do you want to subvert the Christian gospel? I think Alison Lurie's done us a favor. She didn't mean to, but she has, in publishing this article and being so direct about her antipathy towards the Chronicles of Narnia and towards C.S. Lewis. I think it tells us a whole lot about where we stand, and it tells us a whole lot about how our children are targets in the middle of this struggle. Let's go to Judy, calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Judy, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. Couple of things. One, I think if you have kids that aren't able to respect authority or taught not to respect authority, first of all, you've got a bunch of depressed kids out there that have nowhere to turn. You've got kids in school that are having problems. You've got kids that don't know responsibility. But you've also got city streets you can't walk on after dark because you got kids roaming in gangs, because who cares? I'm the authority out there.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point, Judy. You know, I just thought of the psychologist Bruno Bettelheim and his work, The Uses of Enchantment. And in that particular book, he says that fairy tales are useful to us because children have to learn not to trust everyone. And so you need to know about the Wicked Witch of Hansel and Gretel. And you need to know there are people who will do awful things. And, you know, I think our children know that. But Judy, don't you think there's an imbalance in our literature right now to where children, in many ways, reading this stuff, wouldn't trust any adult?
I would tend to think so. I've got two daughters. One's 21, one's 19. The 19-year-old had for a while been reading the Harry Potter books. They had them in school. You know, I thought, well, that's okay, until I heard what they were more about. So we countered the Harry Potter problems with the Chronicles of Narnia. She felt a whole lot better about things. She really enjoyed the Chronicles of Narnia a whole lot more than the Harry Potter stuff.
Yeah, you know, in Harry Potter, in that series, there are some evil adults, as there is, for that matter, in the Chronicles of Narnia. The White Witch is certainly evil. That's very clear. But what's missing in the Harry Potter narratives is any adult that can really help. The adults are standing by, maybe as encouragers at times and as consultants to Harry Potter and his friends Ron and Hermione. But there is no real adult authority figure who can help, who can solve the problem. There is no savior figure. And I think that's why Allison Lurie prefers that story. And Judy, why you prefer the Chronicles of Narnia. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jenny, listening on XM 170, calling from Indianapolis. Go right ahead, Jenny.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I saw you on the Larry King Show. I thought you did very well. It was very interesting.
Well, thank you. That was an interesting program, for sure.
It was. My comment would be, I think we're already seeing in our culture the results of the type of literature that the lady is proponent of. We are already experiencing the lack of respect. We're experiencing the my rules are the only rules. And that's what, you know, that's part of the problem. That's why we need stories like the Chronicles of Narnia. We need movies like End of the Spear. We need all of these Christian influences because, quite frankly, if we don't stick up for our children, the other side's not going to either.
Well, Jenny, I appreciate your call, and what you remind us of immediately is the pervasiveness of mass culture, the fact that our kids are getting these messages. And they're getting it not only by reading the books or watching the movies, but by being around other kids who have. And the messages get filtered through friends, peers, friendships, conversations, and all the rest. And I think that really helps us to understand what we're up against and why it takes strategic parenting. I like that term, strategic parenting. It really takes parents being deliberate and intentional in making sure that our kids are confronted with the right kind of influences. You don't have to worry about them having some of the wrong kind of influences. No matter how you try to protect them, some of it's going to get through. But what are you giving them positively to fill that up? I think what we have here is a clash of worldviews between Allison Lurie and where most Christians would be. She understands that. I just have to wonder if Christians understand that. Let's go to Johnny calling from Lakeland, Florida, listening on WTBN. Johnny, your turn.
Yeah, hi. I do let my children read fantasy, even Harry Potter. But my line is drawn when they make God, if they are blasphemous against God, or they make Christians out to be the stereotypical snobs, or if they push homosexuality. See, that's the kind of stuff that I do cut out. But with Harry Potter, there's one thing that people aren't understanding. It's like Harry Potter's aunt and uncle who are very mean to him and, oh, don't use that magic and that kind of thing. J.K. Rowling could make them out to be the stereotypical snobby Christians if she wanted to, but she doesn't. And she's very respectful of Christmas and Easter, although she doesn't say, you know, this is the Lord's Day or anything like that. I don't see Harry Potter as being so bad.
Yeah, well, Johnny, you know, it'd be so tempting to turn this into another conversation about Harry Potter, and I can guarantee you we'd get calls from all over America. And I'm glad to have Harry Potter mentioned, and I started it myself. But let me tell you, I agree with you in a very essential point, and that is that in the Harry Potter materials, you do not have what you find in Phil Pullman's His Dark Materials. You do not have, like in the Amber Spyglass and all the rest, you do not have the antipathy towards Christianity that you find in the Pullman materials and in some other children's literature and what's categorized as young adult literature. And, you know, this reminds us that discernment requires parents to actually read the materials. And I'm impressed that Johnny, in talking about his own policies and understandings with his kids, knows the stories that they're reading. I think that's a very important aspect of parental responsibility in this age. Wow. You know, when you start thinking about what kids read, just remember the old adage. I remember coming across this in high school, the adage that I was told by a youth minister. It goes like this: I am the sum total of the books I read and the friends that I seek and the messages that I hear. Now, there's more to it than that, but there's something very powerful in that. I am the sum total of my friends, my books, even the music I listen to. Eventually, that begins to shape my culture, my character, and who I am. And when you think about some of the things these kids are reading, watching, and listening to, that's pretty scary. I'll be right back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Don't let people tell you that the age of the book is over. There are people out there writing books right now, and there are books selling by the millions. Local bookstores, especially the big chain bookstores, have a lot to do with which books are sold. Because whether you realize it or not, a lot of it is just point of sale. It's impulse buying. And so when you walk in the bookstore these days and you see the books at the front, the ones that are being featured, I don't mean just the ones that are on the bestseller list, but I mean the ones on the flat tables, the ones in the new fiction and the ones on the special display tables. Someone has a purpose for putting that out there. And it's not all capitalism at work. There's more to it than that. Because people that publish these books and write these books, they understand this is a way to reach minds and hearts. And it's not just brains, it's character. Let's go to Mark, calling on XM 170, listening in Horsehead, New York. Go ahead, Mark.
Good evening, Dr. Mahler. I just had a brief statement. Her desire to do away with respect for authority and leadership, wouldn't that lead to the anarchy for, like, a prime example would be classic literature as Lord of the Flies?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Mark, last year was the 50th anniversary of the publication of Lord of the Flies, and that kind of great myth is exactly, you know, I think what someone like Alison Lurie thinks is probably healthier as a story than the Chronicles of Narnia. There again, you know, you have kids on their own, quite literally, but it turns out very badly, doesn't it? And so maybe she wouldn't like that story in the end after all. It turns out very badly as these boys devolve into anarchy and into lawlessness and into violence towards one another. But Mark, I agree with you. I think it comes down to the fact that if you want anarchy, eventually you'll get it. You know, if that's what you really want, but you won't want it for long. And in reality, you know, here, let's go back to the fact no one is completely anti-authoritarian. I mean, it's hard to find a consistent anarchist. And the moment you have an anarchist party with someone at the head of it, they're not anarchists anymore. Not really, because anarchists can't have leaders. But they do. Why? Because there's something in human beings that necessitates that by the very way that we are made. Now, when you start looking at this in terms of these messages, just know that these folks don't want our children to subvert all authorities. That's not what they want when they show up in the classroom. These professors want them to think like they think. They want to indoctrinate them in a certain worldview. They want to shape their minds and personalities and worldviews and expectations that would match their own. You know, I'm thinking back to an editorial that was written in a magazine published in Seattle just a few months ago in which a college professor said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to let the conservatives have the babies and raise them. And then when they're 18, they'll give them to us, and we'll shape their minds and hearts. Well, folks, that guy was just a little more honest than a lot of others. It's been a good discussion. Thanks for thinking with me, and we'll be back tomorrow for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.